طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is so important that it is presented each week on This Week in Palestine. Columbia University professor Rashid Khalidi has written a new book tracking what he calls the 100-year war on the land of historic Palestine. Dr. Khalidi is an historian, but this book is more than pure history. Khalidi's family has deep roots in Palestine, and his great-great-great-grandfather was mayor of Jerusalem, and his book is spiced with personal narrative. He spoke about his new work recently at the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C., with its executive director, Mohammed Mohammed. This week's feature presentation is that conversation.
So today we have, it's an honor and a pleasure, again, to welcome back Dr. Rashid Khalidi. We have a book talk today with him for his latest book, which is called The 100 Years War on Palestine, A History of Settler Colonialism and Resistance from 1917 to 2017. So just to give a quick description about the book before Dr. Rashid goes into detail. This book is about a landmark history of 100 years of war waged against the Palestinians from the foremost U.S. historian of the Middle East, told through pivotal events and family history. So in 1899, more than 100 years ago, Yusuf Dia al-Khalidi, mayor of Jerusalem, was alarmed by the Zionist call to create a Jewish national home in Palestine, and he wrote a letter aimed at Theodore Herzl, and the country had an indigenous people who would not easily accept their own displacement. He warned of the perils ahead, ending his note, "In the name of God, let Palestine be left alone." Thus, Dr. Rashid Khalidi, who is Yusuf al-Khalidi's great-great-nephew.
Great-great-great-nephew
begins the sweeping history, the first general account of the conflict told from an explicitly Palestinian perspective. Drawing on a wealth of untapped archival materials and the reports of generations of family members, which includes mayors, judges, scholars, diplomats, journalists, the 100 Years' War on Palestine upends accepted interpretations of the conflict, which tend at best to describe a tragic clash between two peoples with claims to the same territory. Instead, Dr. Khalidi traces a 100 years war of colonial, 100 years of colonial war on the Palestinians, waged first by the Zionist movement and then Israel, but backed by Britain and the United States. He highlights the key episodes in this colonial campaign from the 1917 Balfour Declaration to the destruction of Palestine in 1948, or the Nakba, and then from Israel's 1982 invasion of Lebanon to the endless and futile peace process. Original, authoritative, and important, the 100 Years' War on Palestine is not a chronicle of victimization, nor does it whitewash the mistakes of Palestinian leaders or deny the emergence of national movements on both sides. In reevaluating the forces arrayed against the Palestinians, it offers an illuminating new view of a conflict that continues to this day. And just for everybody, most of you probably already know a lot about Dr. Rashid, but just a little bit about him. He is the author of Palestinian Identity, Brokers of Deceit, and The Iron Cage, among others. His writing has appeared in the New York Times, the Boston Globe, Los Angeles Times, Chicago Tribune, and many other journals. He is the Edward Said Professor of Modern Arab Studies at Columbia University in New York and editor of the Journal of Palestine Studies. But without further ado, please welcome Dr. Rashid Khalidi. And thank you again, Dr. Rashid. And thank you to everybody that is watching online right now.
Thanks, Muhammad. Thanks for having me again. It's a pleasure to be hosted by the Palestine Center. I wish it was in D.C. I wish it were live. But I'm afraid we're going to be dealing with this kind of virtual event for a very long time, unfortunately. But I'm really glad some people are able to tune in via Facebook. I'm grateful to you guys for giving me the opportunity to talk about the book. I want to talk about two aspects of the book. One is that it's not a standard history of the conflict. I was pressed by my son, Smail, by other friends and relatives to try and write a book that was more for the general reader than for a specialist audience, more for people who don't know a great deal about Palestine or who know a lot about Palestine, but aren't experts. And I was also very strongly urged to include more personal information, to include more family material, mainly from my own family, but also from other families. So I did something that's very different from any of the other seven books that I've written, other six books that I've written, which is to say, I actually talked about myself, talked about experiences I had had, things I had witnessed, things people had told me. I tried at the same time to document everything quite rigorously. So for those of you who are interested in the historical details or in the sourcing, there are 45 pages of footnotes. You don't have to read them, but if you're interested in where I got some of the stuff I used, that's where you can find it. And so that's one aspect of the book. It has a personal tone to it, especially in the later chapters where I myself was involved. I tell a story of several things that my father told me. My father worked at the United Nations. My father had encounters with various people. I retell those stories. And then I talk about things that actually happened to me, whether during the siege of Beirut in 1982 or during the negotiations in Madrid and Washington, in both of which cases I was there. And I relate my own personal experiences. At the same time, this is the other aspect of the book. I'm trying to shift an existing false narrative in the United States about the conflict in Palestine. And that false narrative has to do with the idea that this is a tragic conflict between two peoples, two national movements. The best version of it says right versus right. And it's very, very sad. They both have claims, but they're more or less equal. And then given the sympathy that exists overall for Israel, the outcome is understandable. Poor Palestinians get left to the side. And moreover, this is an essentially false framing. So this book, I think, uses a frame, and at the same time is meant to shift us away from this ridiculous idea of a struggle between equals. This has always been a monumentally unequal conflict between an indigenous people and a powerfully supported, externally based colonial movement intending to implant new people in place of the indigenous population of the country. Now, this is therefore a settler colonial project. Zionism always was a settler colonial project in its own estimation, in its own self-description for its first 50 or 60 years. Herzl said that, founder of the modern political Zionism, Theodore Herzl. Chaim Weizmann, the first president of the State of Israel, was very blunt about this. Both of them, in private in particular, made no bones about the fact that this was a settler colonial movement. At the same time, this is the complication, it was entirely unlike any other settler colonial movement in that it was also a national movement. It was not rooted in a metropole. So the French settlers who went to Algeria didn't set up a separate entity in Algeria. They considered themselves part of France. They had taken over Algeria for France, and they were an extension of the mother country. The same was true with British colonialists in North America, or Australia, or New Zealand. They did not intend at the outset to set up a separate, different state. They were part of a mother country. That's not true of Zionism. Zionism grew up among Jewish populations, persecuted Jewish populations of Eastern Europe, who chose to establish an entirely new national entity in Palestine. So it's I try and argue that what we're talking about in Palestine is a classical settler colonial, a case of settler colonialism, but with very important differences, such that in the end you do have two peoples, but not two peoples in a position of equality. Two peoples in which one has always been supported, that is to say the Zionist movement and later the State of Israel, by the greatest powers of their era. Great Britain had untrammeled power from World War I until World War II. It was the global hegemon. It supported Zionism to the hilt right up to the eve of World War II. The United States, the Soviet Union became the superpowers. They're the ones that rammed through the partition resolution of 1947, which was the basis for Israeli statehood. It was the United States and the Soviet Union with their arms deliveries, with their diplomatic support, with their financial support, that made the creation of the State of Israel possible. And it's been American, mainly American support, but also the support of others, Europe, some Arab governments, and others, without which Israel could not possibly have achieved the successes it has achieved. So you had a big thumb on the scale. It wasn't just tiny little Israel or the few Jewish settlers in the period before 1948 up against large numbers of Palestinians or even larger numbers of Arabs. It was, in fact, a very well-organized, very highly motivated settler colonial movement with a national focus and with the spur of persecution, of anti-Semitism, pushing people towards Zionism that faced the Palestinians. So that's the second aspect of the book. It has an analytical framework, which is based on this settler colonial paradigm, and which argues that you can best assert, which I call declarations of war on the Palestinian people, the first of them being the Balfour Declaration, and then I talk about five others coming right up to the Trump plan, which in effect is the last of these six declarations of war on the Palestinians. So I'm arguing that this is not just a struggle between the Palestinian people, the indigenous population of Palestine, and a settler colonial movement that's created a new national entity. It is a struggle between the Palestinians and that settler colonial movement, now epitomized in Israel, with very powerful backing from the outside. So that's the basic thesis of the book. That's the argument I'm trying to make in it. I hope it's accessible and easy to read for people. I wrote it very differently than anything I've ever written. Most of the time I was thinking of a narrow audience of academics and specialists and experts and historians in the books that Mohammed mentioned, for example. By and large, they were written for specialist audiences. This was not written for a specialist audience. It's written for anybody who's interested in Palestine.
Yeah, and actually I looked at it, and it does seem like something that could be easily read by anybody, especially somebody that's interested in the history, but it does seem like something that could be, it's very accessible to everybody, so that's great.
Yeah, that was my most important objective in writing this book. I've experienced an enormous change in academic writing on Palestine. When I was an undergraduate, and later on when I was a graduate student in the United States and then in the United Kingdom, there were very few sources on Palestine that weren't either biased or basically unsympathetic to, not only unsympathetic to the Palestinians, but that framed the conflict in a way that I understood from my own experience and my knowledge of the history through my own family and through my own experiences to be largely false. That's not the case today. Today, there's a very wide range of very solid academic writing that I think properly frames this conflict. And I don't think that there's on the academic level, on the scientific level, we're in the situation we were in 30 or 40 or 50 years ago. The Palestinian narrative and an objective narrative is actually available to anybody who's interested. The Zionist narrative is still out there. with all of its faults. But at least people today have a choice between largely false history and largely, you know, accurate history. And so in terms of what's available academically and to specialists, I think we've really turned the corner. In American universities, some of the ridiculous lies that have been peddled by Zionism since the very beginning, land without a people for a people without a land, making the desert bloom, and so on and so forth, are entirely discredited in academic circles that specialize in anything to do with literature or society or history.
Well, you know, it's
go ahead.
It's not just academic circles, but also, like, for example, my dad, who, you know, my grandfather could name more even, but my dad himself could name like 8 generations of his grandfathers that lived in the village in Palestine that we come from. So it's academic, but it's also just people live there. I mean, like you said, you know, a land without a people. I mean, that's just completely false.
Of course. Of course. That's something else I try and give voice to in this book, which is the lived experience of people, of Palestinians, is completely ignored. I mean, there are whole books on the Nakba, for example, by the Israeli historian, I'm blanking on his name, Benny Morris, which in fact accurately described massacres, expulsions, ethnic cleansing, though he will not use that term, but which rigorously refuse to accept the narratives of the 750,000 of Palestinians who were forcibly uprooted from their homes. So that voice is not in much of the history, I should say. That's now being corrected. So the kinds of experiences that your family had, I mean, you know how your great-great-great-great-great-grandparents lived in the same village that your parents or grandparents grew up in. I know how my own ancestors lived in Jerusalem. I mean, there are records. We know. I sit there and I talk to people and they tell me about their great-grandparents in my own family. Those elements I tried to bring in. Now, your family is not characteristic of Muhammad. My family is not characteristic. But together, these are accounts from a Palestinian perspective which are completely ignored. And so, even though my own family is, you know, perfectly unrepresentative in many ways, I try and bring in things that I learned from my aunts and my uncles, things I knew about my grandfather and my grandmother and so on. And I try and bring those things in because that lived experience of the Palestinians has been something that there's been an insistence on excluding. Because if the Palestinians can't speak for themselves, if the Palestinians don't have what Edward Said called permission to narrate, then they can be excluded. Then they don't exist. And of course, that's the whole point. If you're substituting one people for another, one of your primary objectives is to make out that that people doesn't really exist. They're not real. There's some folks there, but they're of no account. And in the incident that you relate, where my great 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 uncle wrote to Herzl. Herzl's reply to him, which I cite in the book, indicates that he considered the Palestinians of no account. They could be ignored. He did reply. He very courteously replied to Yusuf the Al-Khaldi. But his reply showed something that I argue is symptomatic of Zionism and of many of Zionism's supporters in the United States and Britain. Palestinians are not important. We don't have to pay attention to them.
Yeah, they're expendable.
They're expendable. And in order to for that maneuver to be successful, they have to be disappeared. They have to be denied permission to narrate. And that's one of the many things that this book and much other stuff that's out there now is trying to argue against.
How long did this book take you to, you know, with the research and everything? I mean, you know, we all know the history is there, but how long did it take you to research everything?
Well, there are two possible answers to that question. The easy answer is I actually conceived of and wrote the book in the form in which it came out over the last 3 or 4 years. It took me a little more than 4 years. But in fact, there are issues and incidents and important episodes in that book that I had researched and thought about and written about going back decades. The chapter on 1982, for example, the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, the siege of Beirut, the Sabra and Shatila massacres are things that I experienced, things I actually wrote an entire book about. I wrote a book called Under Siege, which is about the PLO's decision to leave Beirut. I did an entirely new research in the course of the last 3 or 4 years using documents I had never seen before. Israeli documents, American documents, which show things about the Sabra and Shatila massacres, things about American complicity in the war that when I wrote the earlier book, I wasn't fully aware of. In fact, nobody was aware of. This is the first time some of this stuff has been published. Similarly, I wrote a whole book on the negotiations in Washington and Madrid that I was a part of. But since then, I have done new research. So there are aspects of this book that I've been doing research on for decades, actually. And some of that research I've used as the basis for books that I've written before. But this is new in the sense that I have all kinds of new material that is added here. And I've added a lot of material that I would never have put in a purely academic book. So on the one hand, it took me three to four years. But really, I've been working on aspects of this book for 30 or 20 years.
And so this new archival material that you uncovered, how is it being preserved? I mean, my grandparents are the ones that left Palestine, for example. So, and my grandparents have all passed away. So how will these types of things be preserved moving forward for the new generations? I mean, I have full confidence, honestly, even the Palestinian youth nowadays are still very firmly, in support of this struggle. But how do you think these things will be preserved moving forward? Do you have any recommendations about that? Because frankly, we can't rely on any Israeli source to,
no.
That's not going to happen.
Part of the problem.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, that's a really good question, Mohammed. Let me start from the end because what you mentioned is really important. One of the things that the process of disappearance of the Palestinians entails is to disappear their history. So there has actually been a war on the Palestinian archive. Israel attacked the PLO Research Center in Beirut several times, ultimately seizing the archives of the PLO Research Center. They were later returned to the PLO as a part of a prisoner exchange. It shut down the Arab Studies Society in Jerusalem. It's still shut down. The materials that were stolen from the PLO in 1982 and from the Arab Studies Society in the 1990s, I believe, or 2001, I believe, were then taken to the Israel State Archives and put under a category called abandoned property, AP,
right,
together with books that had been stolen in 1948 from Palestinian libraries in Jaffa, Haifa, and West Jerusalem. So there's a whole body of Palestinian history, which Israel has basically stolen. And so if you want to access it, you can access it through the Israel State Archives. But you have to be able to go to Israel and get security clearance and be able to speak Hebrew and be allowed to see these materials. Other materials are in the Israel State Archives, where the same kind, even more rigorous vetting process is necessary. So Israel has stolen, seized, and taken advantage of a variety of archives for Palestinian history. Let's start from there. And that's not a casual process. That's not an accidental process.
Yeah, it's
that
very
intentional.
Yeah.
Okay. The answer to your question is multiple. There are multiple answers to your question. What do we do about this? Well, the first thing we do is we preserve records. And now this can be done on an individual basis, but it's best done institutionally. So one of the things that the Institute for Palestine Studies in Beirut does is to try and put, and in Ramallah, there's a branch in Ramallah, there's a branch in Beirut. We have an office in Washington, D.C. as well. But the archives are in either Beirut or in a safe place outside of Beirut or in Ramallah. And they're being digitized. So even if the actual physical paper or document or photograph is destroyed, there's a permanent record of it.
Yeah, in a safe way. And I feel digitization is the key nowadays. Once it's somewhere on the internet, it's basically there forever.
Right. Well, you have to protect it. And you also have to spend a lot of money updating your digital platforms.
Right.
Because I have written and stored material on platforms that are completely inaccessible in 2020, back in the 1990s and the early part of this century. The final part of the answer to your question is oral history. And there are a number of pioneers of oral history, Rosemary Sayegh, May Sayali, pioneers, Julie Petit, a number, mainly anthropologists and historians, who the people at the American University of Beirut Library, who've put together a Nekba archive, and many others are doing this. Bir Zeit has done a wonderful job on this. And these are archives not just of the Nakba, but of everyday life in villages, of social relations in Palestinian cities, and so on and so forth. This is very, very important. And this is something they can't seize, in a sense, once it's digitized and recorded. Obviously, not anybody can record oral history. You have to have the right kinds of questions, which requires a certain kind of historical background. It requires a training in oral history. But if you have those things, it can be done very simply. I would urge everybody, ask your grandmothers or grandfathers. It's mainly the grandmothers and the aunts who are still
right.
alive.
Right. Yeah.
Ask your grandmothers and your aunts, and if they're alive, your grandfathers and your uncles. Anything you can ask them, or your parents even, while they are still, you know, able to remember and their memories are good, and record it. It is of enormous value. Every time somebody dies, a memory goes out of the world that is irretrievable.
I totally agree. And I actually, that's the one thing that I regret, but you know, it's kind of not my fault, but my paternal grandfather passed away in 98. I was young at the time, so I couldn't do that. My maternal grandfather passed away in 2008. But I really wish that I had just, you know, taken a voice recorder and had them, you know, speak about this kind of stuff. So like you said, anybody who's listening and that has Palestinian grandparents that lived through the Nakba and were in Palestine, I would highly recommend just sit down with them for an hour or so and just, you know, take down their memories, their stories. Because like you said, the oral history is very important. And if we don't record it, then it's going to be lost forever.
It's particularly important in the Palestinian case because we have never had and do not have a state. Normally, states take charge of things like historical memory. They do it badly or they do it well, but they do it. You have national archives, you have national museums, you have all kinds of national institutions for commemorating the past of the nation. The Palestinians, we have never had those things. We've never had a state, and we've therefore never had those kinds of state institutions. We have some wonderful civil society institutions, some wonderful NGOs. We're cursed by not having a state, but we're also blessed by not having a state because it's forced others to take up the slack. The last thing I'll say is that even a trained historian has the same regrets that you have. I and many of my friends who work in the historical field can't forgive ourselves for not having asked enough questions when we were young enough to have access to the memories of the oldest people in our families. I used some of my aunts and uncles as sources for material I worked on. Actually, I actually did research. I wrote a whole paper based largely on something that my aunt told me back in Beirut in the late 1970s. And I used especially my other aunts and some of my uncles and some of my older cousins as sources, but I kick myself day in, day out for not having done more of that. So I would say this is true for Palestinians and non-Palestinians. If you want to know about your family, ask people while they're still around. My kids ask me questions I can't answer. My parents are gone. My wife's parents are gone. We can't answer questions that our children ask us about our own families. So take advantage of people while they're still there. Their memories our treasure trove.
Sure. So how do you think moving forward? I mean, you know, we're kind of at this point where, you know, at first you would think things would get better over time, but as you know, things are getting worse politically, at least, you know, with everything going on with Israel and its annexation plans. The right of return, which applies to my family, for example, because we come from a village that's in the Galilee. So how do you see this moving forward? I mean, what is it going to take for Palestinians to actually receive justice for what happened to them? I mean, you know, I have family members that are sitting in refugee camps in Lebanon and Syria, for example. And they would love nothing more than to just go back to where they came from.
Right.
So what do you think moving forward, how is this going to play out? What do you think it's going to take?
I mean, that's a very big question. And I'll do my best to answer it. The first thing it's going to take is a upheaval among Palestinians. The Palestinian National Movement has seen ups and downs in the century and a little more since World War I. And it's now in one of its deepest troughs, one of its lowest points. It's divided. It has a bankrupt leadership. It has no political strategy whatsoever. There is no strategy. There's a bankrupt strategy in Ramallah, a failed strategy in Ramallah, and there's a failed strategy in Gaza. And the two of them together have done less to further the Palestine cause than a bunch of civil society organizations. I mean, BDS has done more for Palestine. Student activists in the United States and Europe have done more than for Palestine, furthering the Palestinian cause than both governments have done in their entire existence. In fact, they have they pushed the Palestine cause backwards at a time when civil society was managing to push it forward. So the first thing is that we as Palestinians have to get our act together. And that is going to be very difficult. There are powerful actors that are working day and night to keep the Palestinians divided, not just Israel, not just the United States. Major Arab countries have as their primary objective keeping the Palestinians and other parts of the Arab world weak and divided and undemocratic. So that's a big hurdle to overcome. But that's the first step. You have to have some kind of unified national movement and some kind of clear strategic objective before you can expect to get anywhere. I mean, it's the absolute precondition. And we're not there, and we may not be there for a little while, but that is the first thing. The second thing is another precondition for keeping the Palestine question off the front burner and keeping the Palestinians weak and divided is dictatorial, unrepresentative governments in the Arab world that are weak and dependent on outside forces, that are the playthings of outside forces. This is has been a constant since the 1930s, when the Arab states first became involved in the Palestine question. It was a problem in the 1940s, and it's been a problem ever since. In fact, it is one of the major problems today. It's not just Arab states, it's also regional states. Turkey, Iran are fishing in troubled waters in Palestine, playing this faction off against the other. And part of this is due to a lack of democracy in the Arab world. It's also due to rivalries and other things. And so the idea that the Palestine struggle is separate from what happens in the Arab world is actually false. It's always been intimately related to the situation of the Arab world. As long as the Arab countries are weak and divided and led by unrepresentative, undemocratic governments, the Palestine question is not going to take the place that it should. And it'll be impossible for the Palestinians by themselves, even if they were to restore their national unity and decide on a clear political strategy, it would be impossible for them to do it all by themselves. They need support from the region. And to have that, you need democratic governments. If you look at the governments that are the most engaged in massive normalization with Israel, they are the most dictatorial, they are the most absolute monarchies or military dictatorships. If you look at the countries where it's much harder to push through normalization, where there is public support for the Palestinians, it's countries like Tunisia, Lebanon, where you have some forms of democracy. Even Morocco,
that's Jordan, very true.
Kuwait, which have problematic systems are countries where there is public opinion that expresses itself in favor of Palestine, and governments can go only so far. Watch the situation in the Sudan. Civil society is supportive of the Palestinians. The military, supported by autocratic Gulf regimes in this evolving Sudanese political situation, the military is normalizing with Israel.
Right.
So, those regimes, it's not for the Palestinians to change them. It's for the peoples in the Arab world. But that is a struggle that has to also work out. Finally, if you accept that Zionism is a settler colonial project, and you accept that the state of Israel, although it's a very powerful state, nation state, although the Israeli people are people that exist and they have an enormous amount of strength as a people. We've seen this again and again. This idea that Israel is some kind of weak, easily divided society is complete nonsense, peddled only by people who know nothing whatsoever about Israel. In spite of that, it is dependent on the outside world. It's particularly dependent on Europe, which does most of the trade with Israel. Israel's almost all, the vast bulk of Israel's trade is with Europe. The vast bulk of investment in Israel is from the United States. It's not just investment by companies like Microsoft or right. Motorola or whatever. It's billions and tens of billions of dollars that come to Israel in the way of charitable 501c3 contributions. Friends of the IDF, friends of Hadassah Hospital, friends of this, friends of that. Billions of dollars.
Well, friends of IDF, they raised tens of millions in just one night. Just from one. Yeah.
So changing that situation, daunting though it may seem, in Europe and the United States, is something that actually is also essential. So Palestinian unity, some improvement in the Arab situation, and a proper attention to the importance of the United States in Europe. I mean, it was the Balfour Declaration that started this.
Right.
That was Britain. It wasn't the Zionists.
Right.
The British decided for their own reasons. It was the Partition Resolution. That was the Americans and the Soviets. It was Security Council Resolution 242. That was the Americans and the Israelis. So the 1982 war, the Americans and the Israelis. So there's this external dimension, which sadly Palestinian leaderships in the past and in the present have been too ignorant, too blinded by narrow concerns, too incapable of understanding the world balance of power to pay proper attention to. This was true in the 20s and the 30s, when there was a misunderstanding of the global balance of power and the importance of working in Britain. It was true with the PLO. For all of their successes globally, and they had some of the biggest achievements of the Palestinians were the PLO's diplomatic successes in winning representation and getting the Palestinian voice heard for the first time in history. At the same time, those leaders were very short-sighted and foolish,
right,
and in their understanding of the United States. They thought, if we can talk to Schultz or if we can talk to Baker, then we solve the problem. No, you don't solve the problem. You have to be talking to churches. You have to be talking to unions. You have to be talking to universities. You have to be talking to public opinion, civil society. You don't go to the top. This is not an absolute monarchy like some of the Gulf countries, where you go to the king or the emir or the sultan and the problem is solved. No, the United States is a complicated political system, as are the countries of Europe, and it requires a lot of work. To be fair, and to give this work its due, a lot of that work is actually being done by Palestinian civil society in cooperation with students and others, church groups and unions and so on and so forth, in the United States and Europe. And there has been an enormous improvement in public opinion in these countries, in spite of a counteroffensive fueled by tens of millions of dollars, with lawyers up the wazoo, with organizations, AstroTurf organizations all over the place, and with real political support in some legislatures, in the U.S. Congress, in the German political system, in the French political system. In spite of all of that, there have been enormous achievements on American campuses, in American important American liberal Protestant denominations, and so on and so forth. So that is a third element to get out of the mess we're in. None of this is going to happen tomorrow.
Right.
Zionism did not achieve what it achieved in the United States because in 1947 or in 1967, an Israeli leader said, we're going to go and talk to Harry Truman or we're going to go and talk to Lyndon Johnson. It's because people like Ben-Gurion himself and Yitzhak Ben-Zvi, the second president of Israel, were working in the United States in 1917, 1918, 1919, working hard.
Herzl himself, I mean, they were working on this from a long time.
It's going to require a lot of long-term work before you're going to see a result. But that work is being done, actually, or it's begun. For the first time, I think, in Palestinian history. I don't think that there has been an effort like we're seeing in the last decade or 15 years, at least in the United States.
Well, thank you. That was actually the very thorough answer to that question. And that really sums up everything that probably should be done. So thank you for that. I have a question for you from Mr. Saeed Darakat, who is actually on our Palestine Center Committee. He's also the bureau chief of the Al-Quds daily newspaper here in Washington.
I read his reports all the time.
Okay, great.
He just sent out one this morning.
Yeah. He does one, I think, daily pretty much.
Right.
So he's asking, given all the history that is cited in today's presentation, knowing the facts as they are, what ought to be the one urgent priority or rallying cry that Palestinians should start working on, organizing around immediately? Like what should they do immediately? He said maybe totally independent from the current traditional leadership. So what are your thoughts on that? And if you want, I can repeat the question if you didn't.
No, I got it. I mean, I would go back and say we need to unify our national movement. So some form of unity. I frankly think that the two political movements that dominate politics inside Palestine are bankrupt. I don't think they can be the basis for the future. But there has to be a minimum of unity and there has to be some strategic clarity. We have to decide what we want. I would suggest that the slogan should be something to do with justice and equality. Now, how you implement justice and equality in Palestine opens up a whole series of questions. But that has to be the basis. There has to be absolute equality on an individual basis. Every Israeli Jew and every Palestinian Arab has to be treated on the basis of equality, whether it's in one state, many states, or a single state is not important. The important thing is the principle. And each of those two groups have acquired national rights. You know, nations are not just noble, honorable outgrowths of history. Nations are created, you know, by people's consciousness. And they're often created through unjust processes of conquest or expropriation or colonization. I and you live in a nation state created by colonial expropriation. I live in a city and I live in New York City and I'm today in Chicago, named for Native Americans. This is a colonial settler project that's turned into a nation state. It's based on that and slavery. You live in Washington, D.C. Every one of the oldest buildings there was built by slaves, never compensated for their labor. The White House and the Capitol, slave built. That's the basis of the United States. It's a tragic history, but it's a nation state. The same is true of Israel and the Israeli people. And we like it, we don't like it. It has nothing to do with it, like many other national groupings. We are a national grouping as well, we the Palestinians. So whatever, when you say equality and justice, there has to be complete equality in terms of the people's rights. And that's not just political rights. That's not just civil rights. That's not just rights to property. That's also rights to national existence. How that national existence is exercised is a matter for a debate and a struggle over a long time. But to say they don't have the right to some kind of communal identity and we do, or for them to say they have the right to a community, which the nation state law of 2018, the Jewish nation state law of 2018, said they have the right of communal identity, we don't.
Right.
There's one people in the land of Israel, the Jewish people. Well, that's inadmissible. That's unacceptable. It's also unacceptable to say we're the only people in the land of Palestine. There's another people there created by a settler colonial process, but it's there. Our brothers and sisters who live inside Israel understand that a hell of a lot better than most other Palestinians. They understand exactly what has been created there. Forcibly, they've been made a part of it, a subordinate, discriminated against part of it, but they're part of it. And they understand it perfectly well. I hope other Palestinians will come to understand that. So that means that if somebody who has a relative in Brooklyn can bring them and they become a citizen as soon as they arrive at Ben-Gurion Airport, then someone who lives in Amman should be able to come and become a citizen as soon as they arrive.
Right.
When you say justice and equality, you include things that we talk about in terms of the right of return or an end of occupation or self-determination. You don't narrow yourself down to a political path that is harder to explain. You say, just as in the United States, everybody has equal rights. Everybody in Palestine has to have equal rights. So justice and equality would be, in my view, the broadest framing that we should adopt.
Okay, I have another question for you from Dr. Subhi Randur, who is with the Al-Hiwar Center here, also in the D.C. area. So he is asking about the role of the Palestinians here in the U.S. Regarding the situation in Ramallah and the Arab world, and how to, I guess, push a good Palestinian lobby here in the U.S.
Okay, those are two different questions. Let me talk about the last part, which is the easiest part. You only have an Israel lobby in the United States because people like Ben-Gurion and Yitzhak Ben-Zvi started working on it 100 years ago. We Palestinians who live in the United States. Most of us arrived much later than most of the Jewish population.
Right.
And that means we have a different timeline for us. It took Jews in the United States centuries before they achieved any level of equality, before they were free of many forms of discrimination. And that took a huge struggle. And out of that, they eventually developed powerful community organizations. We're not anywhere near them in terms of a timeline. There are some people who arrived before World War I, before the racist immigration laws of 1924 were put into place, but most Palestinians, most Arabs, most Muslims in the United States arrived after 1965. So we're 100 or 85 years after most other immigrant groups or many other immigrant groups in developing our own communal institutions and in assimilating. Now that's beginning to happen. I look at my children's generation. I look at my students, Arab American, Palestinian American students, and you can see a completely different outlook than existed when I was a student. When I was a student, most Arab Americans or most Arabs in the United States were completely outside of American society. They were not assimilated. They did not feel comfortable. My children's generation.
They just wanted to avoid trouble and just lay low. Yeah.
Or they fought against it, but they were clearly outside of the society. That's less and less true today, especially with the younger generation. That's the basis for doing anything. Those people have to already understand what has to be done. They know American law. They know they feel perfectly American. And at the same time, they are loyal to their roots, as it were.
Right.
Now, lobbying is not something that's done in Washington. It doesn't start at the top. Our fallacy is, if I can talk to Baker, I will solve the problem. No, you don't talk to Baker. You have people in municipal councils. You have people in state legislatures. You have people in the U.S. Congress who talk to Baker. So Baker or Trump or whoever it may be can't ignore you because you have a political base. And you don't do that just by organizing your own people. You do it by intersectionality, talking to Muslims, talking to Indians who are not nationalist, talking to African Americans, talking to Hispanics, talking to LGBTQ groups, talking to church groups, so that anybody who is open-minded enough to listen to the message supports you, and you support them. Our cause is not unique and perfect and the only important thing in the world, which is a fallacy, Palestinian, that we think we're the center of the world. We're not the center of the world. Every one of the groups that I've talked to believes that they are the center of the world. Right. And we have to respect that. If we want them to support us, we have to support them. That's what lobbying involves. Yeah. Getting the base so that you can get to the top.
That reminds me actually of a speaker we had at the Palestine Center a year or two ago. And he was mentioning what you said. It doesn't start at Washington. He was mentioning how even on local city councils, the Zionist groups would basically take them on trips, you know, over to Palestine. So it starts at the local level because they know that some of these local politicians might end up having ambitions to be in state or national level politics. So it starts from the bottom and then trickles up upward, actually.
A famous Massachusetts politician once said, all politics is local. That's where it starts. And it started, I mean, in Paterson, New Jersey, we have a Palestinian mayor. In various parts of this country, there are people running for office, many all over the place, in Texas, in Illinois, in Brooklyn. Those are neighborhoods and areas where there's a large enough population. And the ones who win are ones who don't just organize Arab Americans or Palestinians. They're the ones who can create coalitions. This is a country where ethnic groups still matter. And you have to create coalitions across those ethnic groups and across interest groups. That's what the Israel lobby does. You think they're obsessively focused on Israel? They're not. That's their objective. But they and every lobby in Washington does what it does by doing favors for other people at the same time that they get favors for their own cause. That's the way politics works.
Right. Okay, another question is, this was going back to the whole oral history question, is there an ongoing project in the refugee camps across the Arab world to record these older people's stories from the Nakba and everything? Is there an ongoing project for that?
The ones I'm best aware of are in the West Bank and Lebanon, where there are projects, actually, pretty comprehensive. Also, Tman al-Arba'in, also some Palestinians inside Israel. Mm-hmm. And there are both efforts at the village level, so things like village books, which record legends, stories, histories, narratives, folklore, and history, mainly, and geography of different villages. And then you also have oral history compilations, local and regional. And then you have a variety of places in Beirut at the American University, there is an oral history center for Palestine, for the Nakba specifically. And they have worked in camps all over Lebanon. And in fact, with many Palestinian refugees from Syria being forced, especially from Yarmouk near Damascus, being forced to leave and take refuge in Lebanon, they've had access to both groups. Palestinian refugees living in Syria formerly and Palestinian refugees. I don't know about Jordan. I actually don't know.
How would you, I mean, just as a quick like summary of the concluding remarks for your book, what would you say? For somebody also that's maybe not so well versed in this conflict, that doesn't know the details, and how would you describe that?
Right. Well, one thing I would say is that the project to create Israel and to, in effect, replace the indigenous population with a new population came a century or two centuries too late. A colonial settler project like that had been started in the 18th or 19th century might have had a chance of succeeding by either eliminating the population, as happened in much of North America and much of Australia and New Zealand, or expelling them, or subjugating them fully. That did not happen. The fact that between the river and the sea in historic Palestine, the majority of the population are Palestinians, in spite of all the efforts at ethnic cleansing, at keeping people out, forcing others to leave, is an indication that the project was not a success. Secondly, I would say, and this is something I say in the last chapter of the book, Israel is entirely dependent on liberal democracies. Its values do not comport with the values of liberal democracy. It is not one man, one woman, one vote. It is not the same law applies to all. There are laws that privilege Jews in Israel. There are laws that discriminate against Arabs. In a liberal democracy, that is simply unacceptable. There's a single rule of law that applies to all citizens. That not only doesn't apply to all Israeli citizens, it doesn't apply to the 4.5 or almost 5 million Palestinians that Israel has ruled over for 50 3 years.
Right.
So this is a system that is completely incompatible with the liberal democracies on which it relies largely, the United States.
And not to mention the discrimination that they have even against, the African Jews in Israel.
Exactly.
I mean, I saw that firsthand, and it was pretty obvious that there was discrimination against them.
Well, I mean, many countries have discrimination, but except apartheid South Africa and Jim Crow, the Jim Crow South, that was not expressed in law. In Israel, it's expressed in law. There is legally mandated discrimination. If you're of one religion, you have certain rights. If you're of another, you're deprived of those rights. And in fact, if you live in the occupied territories, you have absolutely no rights whatsoever. No rights whatsoever. You're under the control of an arbitrary authority that you have no influence on, a military authority that decides whether you can register your child, whether you can import, whether you can leave, whether you can export, whether you can drill a well. Anything important is decided by this external arbitrary authority. That is completely incompatible with the ideals of liberal democracy. And so I would argue that that's a reason for optimism. It's simply necessary to bring those facts to light, and you put Israel in a very difficult position. Obviously, it requires much more than just doing that.
Sure. For many years, we spoke about Israel accepting its moral and legal responsibility for what happened to the Palestinians. How important is that for a just peace?
Yeah, I think that's actually a good question. We live in a country, the United States, where some people have all kinds of privilege, mainly economic and class privilege. To get people to give that up is very hard. In Israel, there are powerful structures that reinforce privilege for Israeli Jews, especially Ashkenazi Jews, but any Israeli Jew has rights that others don't have. And those privileges are going to have to be given up if there's going to be a basis, any equal basis for a society or societies in Palestine. And overcoming that is not going to be easy. It's going to require the Palestinians to do things that are going to be very difficult for us, because we're going to have to show Israelis that there is a future in which they can live it on a basis of equality, and that they have to give up enormous privilege and some power in order to get there. So that is not an easy task, especially for the people who have suffered as a result of the establishment of Israel. I mean, what's required of the Palestinians is much harder than what's required of the Israelis. All the Israelis have to do is to give up a lot of false notions and a lot of privilege in order to be accepted on a basis of equality. But that requires their giving up some power, a lot of privilege, and a lot of very false, in many cases, very racist notions.
Sure.
About the people that shares that country with them, however unequal that sharing is right now.
You have been listening to Palestinian historian Rashid Khalidi speaking at the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. To access our permanent archive, to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org and click on This Week in Palestine Archive. This archive was developed and is maintained by our colleague Stan Robinson. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.